Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, private military corporations are increasing in their use in war. How much do they increase the lethality and the likelihood of war? Are private corporations challenging the state's monopoly on war? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Last month, the Wagner Group was reported to have risen in opposition to their Russian employers and threatened the Russian war in Ukraine. While the actual cause of this revolt is in question, and whether the threat was actually real also questioned, it raises the issue of the role that privatized military corporations play in contemporary warfare. Since the end of the Cold War, PMCs have played substantial roles in wars ranging from the war in the former Yugoslavia, to conflict across Africa, to the drug war and the civil war in Colombia, and also providing essential services to the U.S. military and NATO militaries in wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But the implications of this growing trend in war are actually quite significant. Are these PMCs mercenaries? What or who governs their roles in conflicts? How prevalent are they? And do they make war more likely by increasing any country's capacity to fight? Our panel today explores the political, military, legal, and socioeconomic implications of private military corporations. Our panel is Christopher Kinsey. He's lecturer in the Defense Studies Department at King's College London and the author of Corporate Soldiers and International Security, The Rise of Private Military Companies. Anna Leander is professor and chair of the Department of International Relations and Political Science at the Geneva Graduate Institute. She's the author of The Power to Construct International Security on the Significance of Private Military Companies. Ori Swed is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work at Texas Tech University. He is the author of No Accounting for Bad Contracting, Private Military and Security Contracts, and Ineffective Regulation in Conflict Areas. And Sorka McLeod, associate professor at the University of Copenhagen and a member of the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries. She's the author of Certifying Private Security Companies, Effectively Ensuring the Corporate Responsibility to Respect Human Rights. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. Anna Leander, I'll start with you. Ask the question, are private military corporations mercenaries? How much is this sort of new platform, the new use of these private military corporations, different from state practice of mercenaries, which has been pretty prevalent historically?
Thanks for the question, and thanks for inviting me to join the discussion. So most companies are not private, really, just as most mercenaries were not private. So I tend to talk about commercial security rather than private. It's a long argument, but basically there's so much connection between the public and the private. And we tend to call things mercenary when we don't like them. So mercenaries are the private or commercial security entities that we don't like for some reason. And then we call them mercenaries. So everyone is now calling Wagner mercenaries, but most other companies we wouldn't call mercenaries. And there's a reason. So there's been been changes in the role of commercial security. So there really is something very substantially new about the ways and the prevalence of commercial security in the contemporary world. And it's because we've started to run war and run the military as we run companies. And that's a quite new idea. We didn't used to do that. We used to think that war was about territorial expansion, et cetera. We didn't manage everything. And now we manage everything, including the military. And I would say this isn't the preserve of the US or the UK. It's all over the place, including in China. I've had Chinese students spending time with me at the Graduate Institute thinking about the commercialization of security in China.
Thank you. And Christopher Kinsey, how prevalent are the private military corporations? Anna Leander suggests that they are becoming much more global and there's a lot more sort of presence around the world. Are there a lot more corporations than there were, say, 20, 30 years ago?
I would say that there's a lot more outsourcing of military and security functions by government today than there has been since the end of the Second World War. The idea of a private military corporation, I mean, how do we define this? Military contractors have been working for the US military, British military, actually for militaries, even through the Cold War. And this term, private military company, when we come to define it, my own definition is that it can actually include, for instance, contractors that provide non-lethal force and contractors that can provide lethal force. And they all get clubbed together. And this, I think, is wrong. So military contractors actually span across a whole range of activities for the military, but also other government departments. Now, Anna mentioned the commercialization of security. There is, again, an increase in commercialization, but there's also an increase in lethal commercialization of security. And again, this has been going on since the 1970s. I mean, I remember the rise of international terrorism in Europe, you know, at the end of the 1960s, early 70s, the Bardamontov gang and all the other movements that emerged. And actually what that did was that triggered a market in armed security or armed contractors that were needed by corporations, but also governments to protect assets and individuals. And that has increased. What we have seen with that market is that because war has changed, and now what we're seeing in the conflict zone is not just militaries, but also other government agencies working alongside militaries. We saw this in Iraq. We're seeing NGOs, for instance, playing a greater role in the conflict zone. And these people are hiring armed contractors. And these armed contractors are often referred to as mercenaries. And Anna has a, you know, she hit the nail on the head when she said, you know, we describe people as mercenaries when we don't like them, you know. So that is a political decision to say that actually we don't like this group of private individuals carrying weapons, they're mercenaries. We actually see this discussion, by the way, in Ukraine, where we refer to Wagner, and by the way, Wagner are not mercenaries in Russia. You cannot be a mercenary in your own country. You can be a private militia, but you can't really be a mercenary. But Wagner in Africa, you could describe them as mercenaries. And there is a legal definition. But my point is, we use the word mercenary to describe Wagner because we don't like them. And by the way, they use the word to describe those members, those individuals from Europe fighting in the International Brigade in Ukraine as mercenaries. So that's a political war there between, you know, conflicting views on two different types of forces. I always think that the classic mercenary really, I think, stems back to the Cold War and what emerged after the Second World War in Katanga and the Congo in the 1960s. And then, of course, we refer to executive outcomes as mercenaries, or we refer to them as a private military company. Actually, they're mercenaries, but they're highly trained and very professional mercenaries compared to what went on in the Cold War. You had the Congo, then you had the Angola debacle with the massacre of British mercenaries by their own leader, had them executed, and the atrocities. And you had the atrocities in Biafra, again, by mercenaries. And then you had the Seychelles and the attempt by Michael, probably one of the classic mercenary leaders of the 20th century, trying to overthrow a legal government. So, well, I suppose my point is, someone's mercenary might be someone's freedom fighter at the end of the day. And I don't think you're ever going to get a consensus on this. So I tend to look at the activities rather than the label in that respect. But I'll leave it at that.
Sorka McLeod?
We're talking about mercenaries as a political tool, but there is a convention on mercenaries, correct? And so what is the legal definition? And, you know, from a legal perspective, what makes somebody a mercenary versus not a mercenary?
As Chris has mentioned, there is a legal definition, and there is an international legal definition, actually, in the Geneva Convention, which is then replicated in different international and regional instruments. So the Geneva Convention determines that somebody who is defined as a mercenary is not automatically entitled to prisoner of war status, but it doesn't criminalize the act of being a mercenary, the recruitment, the training, the financing of mercenarism. And it's a complicated definition, has six elements. So the first element is that you have to be specially recruited to directly participate in hostilities. The second element is that you did, in fact, directly participate in hostilities. That in itself is controversial because there is a disagreement about what it means to directly participate in hostilities. And that's, I think, the political point that both Anna and Chris have been pointing to. Then the third element is that you have to have been motivated by private financial gain. And that financial gain is substantially more than you would receive if you were a member of the regular armed forces. Then if you are a member, if you've been incorporated into the armed forces, you are not defined as a mercenary. If you're a national of a party to an armed conflict, then you are not a mercenary. And that would come back to one of the points that Chris made. So if you ask me, are there mercenaries involved in the Ukraine conflict? The answer is yes and no. It essentially depends on their nationality. Ukrainian nationals or Russian nationals would not meet the definition of mercenary. And then finally, if you've been sent into an armed conflict on official business, such as peacekeeping or for instruction purposes, then you wouldn't meet the definition. Now, that definition is more or less incorporated into the International Convention on Mercenarism, which was negotiated in 1989. The exception or the exclusion is that the requirement to be directly participating in hostilities is not part of that convention. But what it does is it requires the state parties to it to criminalize the act of being a mercenary and the recruitment, the training, the financing, and the use of mercenaries at the national level. At the moment, there are only 37 state parties to that convention. So it's quite problematic. There are, however, many other states beyond those 37 that have provisions at the national level which address different elements of mercenarism. So some states have an absolute prohibition on mercenarism. Switzerland, for example, Russia also has an absolute prohibition on mercenarism. Others will criminalize certain elements, such as the recruitment of mercenaries. So at the national level, it's really a very piecemeal approach to regulating these actors. But what it means is it's actually very, very difficult to be defined as a mercenary, certainly under international law.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic are private military corporations, and our panel is Christopher Kinsey of King's College London, Anna Leander of the Geneva Graduate Institute, Ori Swed of Texas Tech University, and Sorcha McLeod of the University of Copenhagen, also the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries. Ori Swed, one of the things that I find fascinating with respect to these private corporations is at the end of the day, when a state contracts with the corporation, it is a business contract, right? Exactly how much ability do the states, you know, do the militaries have at actually regulating their behavior? And what immediately comes to mind with me was the U.S. military's anger about Blackwater mismanaging what eventually becomes the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq. Is that fairly common that they kind of act a lot more independently than the military itself does?
First, Doug, thank you for having all of us. It's great to be here. This is a great question, but I can tell you that it's changed over time. During the war in Iraq, when there was this massive demand for outsourcing security, contracting was not well regulated. Contracts themselves were not well articulated, and there were a lot of opening for actors, private military security companies, to break contract, to exploit loopholes, to do a lot of things that their employers did not intend them to do. But the thing is that since then, we are almost 20 years after the beginning of the war in Iraq, and governments learn and militaries learn. And they figured out that you can use the contract to better regulate those companies, to better define what they're supposed or not supposed to do. We have better vetting mechanisms. We have international agreements. We have better legal frameworks addressing legal lacunas that we did not have before. So there is progress. But at the same time, every unit, doesn't really matter if it's military unit that you send into nowhere or commercial unit that you send in the middle of nowhere, it's really, really hard to have good oversight. It doesn't really matter if you send people in an oil rig in the middle of nowhere, or you send soldier in a military post in the middle of nowhere, or contractors. It's very, very hard to actually regulate and figure out what's happening and to make sure that they follow the rules and do what you expect them to do.
Can I just come in here with a comment?
Yeah, please, Chris.
First of all, in Iraq, the majority of contractors, and certainly US contractors, were probably employed by the State Department, not the Department of Defense. And this is actually important because the Department of Defense had no legal authority over contractors working for Department of State. And therefore, you had a problem. And this problem actually manifested itself with the Fallujah incident. Those four contractors, I believe, were working for state, and therefore the US military could not tell them what to do. And that, I think, was part of the problem. And they eventually ended up in a situation which they shouldn't have been, and were caught, murdered. And of course, we know the rest of that gruesome story. So obviously, you know, there is tension in that aspect of the relationship that needs to be resolved. So government agencies need to decide on how you're going to regulate these actors in a war zone. The Department of Defense actually did come up with an overall plan, and that was to centralize the control of all contractors through regional hubs. But again, that was voluntary, you know, and Blackwater refused to join, I believe, because Aegis got the contract, which was a British company, and they weren't going to be told what to do by a British company. So again, friction in that. I think you raised a really important point, oversight and accountability. In the case of contractors working for government agencies, you know, that government agency is responsible for oversight of contractors. I think it's more worrying when they're working for the corporate world rather than government agencies, because the corporate world, you know, will think, well, you know, you've done something bad there, gentlemen, but we'll push that under the carpet. You know, we don't want that out in the public domain because that could impact on our reputation. And we do know that of numerous human rights violations went on in Iraq during this period, and that many contractors were not held accountable for this. And these contractors probably work for both government agencies, but also commercial entities. So it's the commercial entity I'm more worried about in one sense than government agencies, where if they're told they will behave in this way, they will behave in this way. Otherwise, they will be penalized and the contract, they can have the contract removed from them. So it's the commercial sector, I think, that is actually more worrying from my perspective.
And Ori Swag, you had something you want to jump in?
Yeah, a follow-up. I think that the conversations on mercenaries is more exotic. It attracts much more attention. But in fact, we have a massive industry here that we gave that industry permission to use coercive violence in variety of capacities. Now, for the most part, they are doing an okay job. They are not Wagner. Nonetheless, we have all those people all over the world with guns, with permission to shoot, permission to arrest, and we don't really explore what's happening there their training, their regulation, oversight on what they do, the worker status, and the worker's right. Because if you put someone without training and without legal protection and send them in the middle of nowhere and they commit some sort of a misstep and hurt someone, who is responsible? What does it mean? We have a real problem that we may want to pay attention to, but all of us all the time keep on talking about Wagner as if that is the face of that industry or Blackwater back then. And we need to be able to focus on the broader picture, to focus on the real industry and not this very interesting anecdote.
Sorka McLeod, I want to get into a legal question here then, because, I mean, corporations could have legal liabilities if individual acts of violence, human rights violations, and atrocity is committed in the United States if a soldier is accused of that. That soldier would be bound by the Uniform Code of Military Justice and could be court-martialed. In the case of corporations, is there any framework where an individual working for a corporation that goes and shoots a bunch of civilians or, you know, violates the laws of war could actually be prosecuted for that crime?
I mean, in some senses, it doesn't matter what type of actor you're talking about. If anyone commits a war crime or a crime against humanity in the context of an armed conflict, they can be held responsible under the laws of war and under international humanitarian law, and they can be prosecuted and held to account. That will depend on how a particular country decides to approach it. We might see somebody being held responsible at the International Criminal Court. Now, that's not happened so far, but what we have seen is, in addition to the framework around mercenaries, which criminalizes the specific act of being a mercenary, that we do have, you know, we have made progress in the sort of 15, 20 years since the Balkans and the war in Iraq, in the sense that we do have the Montreux document, which brings together existing international legal provisions around state responsibility for the actions of private military and security contractors. That's the language that's used in the Montreux document. And we also have the International Code of Conduct Association, which oversees the International Code of Conduct for private security providers. And the whole, you know, the whole raison d'etre, the whole reason that those instruments came into being, they were driven by the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Swiss government, was as a direct result of the human rights harms and the violations of humanitarian law by these kinds of actors in multiple armed conflicts. And so the code specifically envisages that what they call private security providers who are operating in complex environments, which would be an armed conflict or a situation where the rule of law has been damaged by an environmental disaster or a humanitarian disaster, that they will comply with international human rights law and that they will comply with international humanitarian law. And the way that it's envisaged working is that the member companies of the association, they are audited against certain management standards, which cover all sorts of corporate governance elements, as well as human rights elements. And so a company is audited, it then takes its certificate to the International Code of Conduct Association and says, we got this management standard certification, which says we are, we're trying to comply with the code. And then the International Code of Conduct Association says, right, we want to see some more additional information. And then at that point, the ICOCA, the association, determines whether they will be certified as complying with the International Code of Conduct. Now, there are a lot of problems with the process. The companies aren't always, you know, reaching the highest standard, but a lot of the companies that are members of ICOCA are doing significantly better than they were 15 years ago. Having said that, There are, I think it's over 130 companies are now members of the International Code of Conduct Association. But globally, there are thousands and thousands of private security companies operating. So there's still a long way to go. But I think it's, you know, we have, there has to be some balance there. I should also say that the international community is trying to create an international instrument at the UN level via what's called an open-ended intergovernmental working group process. And we do have a draft of an instrument. I call it Schrodinger's instrument because states have been unable to agree on whether it should be a binding instrument or whether it should be a soft instrument. And so at the moment, we have an instrument that is trying to be both. And it has language that is relevant for a treaty, a binding instrument, and language that is relevant for a soft instrument. And states have not yet been able to agree on some of the fundamental elements, so that the form that this instrument should take and whether it should apply to all private security actors or only those that operate extraterritorially. But again, one of the good things about it is that it has moved in the right direction in terms of helping to protect victims and to ensure accountability, which and ultimately actually trying to prevent the violations happening in the first place. So there has been a lot of movement in the right direction, but there's still a very long way to go.
And Anna Leander, I guess a big kind of existential question that I'm asking you here, but what ultimately is the primary motivation for states to hire private military corporations? Is it largely economic, that it's cheaper to do? Is there a political kind of plausible deniability, or, you know, you assign to the PMC things you don't want your military to necessarily have to do, or a way to internationalize a conflict that isn't necessarily international? I mean, are those some of the trends? Are there things I'm missing?
Thanks a lot. Let me answer that, not by copping out really, but just saying there are very, very many different motives. And of course, it depends a little bit on why why one is interested in hiring. And that allows me, so I agree with everything that's been said. It's a very interesting discussion. And I think it's very important. So Chris and Ori were emphasizing that it's not only states that hire, but it's also commercial entities and actually also universities. You know, I trot around trade fairs, and now that I have a professor badge and regularly someone tries to sell me security for my students doing field work. So, you know, it's really spreading out. And it's quite important to think about this. So when Chris introduced the history of the sector, he put a lot of emphasis on the shifting nature of warfare. But there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem, because when you have a commercial sector, you know, commercial entities are defined by, you know, the need to market and basically sell their services and products. And so that they, of course, and I don't think one should see it only as vile lobbying and whatever profit seeking. One can also see it as security professionals trying to help people live a more secure life or whatever when they go to dangerous contexts, which they do. You know, it could be a journalist and a very well-meaning NGOs. NGOs also rely extensively on this sector. They want to support them and make sure they do that in safe fashion. But that then, of course, if you think you have a bunch of people that think constantly about how to make life safer for us and prioritize that, that of course becomes something that shifts how we see our activities. So I'm an old lady, I'm an academic, I do field work. I've lived through enormous changes that I think have been driven partly by changes on the ground, but really it's not that the world wasn't dangerous before, it was dangerous, but also driven by the fact that there are now services, you know, companies that can help me see this and deal with, and that's me individually, but of course it's also states. And that is a long-winded answer to saying I think there's a real expansionary capacity of markets. And, you know, when we think of companies elsewhere, we think this is very positive growth. You know, it's what we want, progress, expansion. And in this sector, of course, that means something rather different So maybe we don't always want it. And also because of the slightly, Chris also, just getting back to Chris again, put a lot of emphasis on the distinguishing, you know, let's be clear. Let's say that there's people who deal in lethal services. But of course, when we digitize everything, the boundaries of what a lethal service is, does that involve our computer systems? I found myself recently saying Microsoft is a private military company. Okay, we have a sort of expansion of what it means to engage in this. I could go on. So that's just a long way of saying it really depends on who hires for what, and what people hire for is partly related to what they understand that they need. And, you know, it's not something objectively given. You know, I don't look at the world and I know, oh, this is the kind of security I need. I need someone professional to help me sort that out, think it through. And, you know, I'm very happy they're around because I would certainly not be very good at it. But the consequence is this, I've talked about it in terms of exceptional creativity. So, you know, so create the services for exceptional circumstances in a very creative way that then expands this market. Thanks a lot.
Historically, states had a monopoly on using military force, but private corporations are challenging this monopoly. Do they make war more likely and more lethal? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the consequences of relying on private military corporations? How much can these private armies be regulated? And what are the obstacles to regulation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Christopher Kinsey, lecturer in the Defense Studies Department at King's College London; Anna Leander, professor of international relations, actually chair of the International Relations Political Science Department at Geneva Graduate Institute; Ori Swed is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work at Texas Tech; and Sorka McLeod, associate professor at the University of Copenhagen and member of the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries. Chris Kinsey, I want to return back because you had highlighted with a history of the use of mercenaries and the role that the private actors played. You mentioned Katanga, for example, where mercenaries were basically being, being hired by mining interests as a way to try to protect them from the state. And so it's not a new question, but immediately when I think of the privatization of military, I think this is the IR scholar in me, the international relations scholar in me, says this is really a challenge to sovereignty in a way, kind of a fundamental challenge to sovereignty, if states no longer have any form of a monopoly over security questions. First of all, how significant is that challenge? And then what does that mean for the likely outbreak of war?
Well, actually, I would say the exact opposite. My most recent book, The Mercenary, An Instrument of State Coercion, suggests the opposite. What it actually suggests is that states rely more and more on these type of actors to achieve foreign policy objectives. Now, what we don't know, for instance, is what's happening in Syria regarding US, UK government use of private contractors. Actually, those in that country, I would probably refer to as mercenaries. We have no idea. They're not being operated by the military or the State Department. I think they're probably working for the intelligence agencies. We have Yemen, again, where we know there have been activity by military contractors or mercenaries. Again, who's operating them? Who's controlling them? This is an instrument that intelligence services use, I think, quite often. During the Cold War, for instance, one of the most successful operations was in the Congo again, but it was the CIA's use of Cuban pilots to support the ground forces, and these were mercenary ground forces, and the African the ANC, not the African National Congress, but the Army Nationale Colonies. Though that force was deniable from the American perspective, and they could easily deny having anything to do with that. There was, again, the mercenary operation in Yemen in the 60s. That went up to the highest levels of government in the UK. You know, you had the Hilton assignment, which was organized by David Sterling, the founder of the SAS. And again, the intelligence service was involved. They actually stopped the operation because it came public knowledge. So they put an end to it. My point is, governments are probably the biggest user of this industry than the commercial sector. That doesn't mean the commercial sector isn't important. And this industry is getting bigger, and getting bigger for the very wrong reasons. The world is getting more violent, and therefore people think they need private security or commercial security in this respect. But coming back to your point, you know, it's government that is using this industry, I think, more than probably the commercial sector, and using it for activities that it wants to hide from public view. It's as simple as that. And you come back to deniability, and that they can actually deny anything to do with this industry. I will give you an example, and this is now in the public domain, by the way. A few years ago, I found out that a British company is training Lebanese border guards. I put a request into the Foreign Office to ask them, is this the case? It took me, I think, about 4 years to finally get an answer out of them. And it went to two tribunals. And in the end, what they actually said is, yes, we are using a contractor to train the Lebanese border guards. Now, all this documentation is in the public domain, so you can actually Google it and you'll get the documentation. A complete lack of transparency. You know? So how much more of this is going on? You know, the French government employed a private security company in Sudan quite recently to help with the evacuation of French citizens in the country. You know? We hear about Wagner. What we don't hear about is what our own governments are doing regarding this this industry. So are they a threat to sovereignty? They may be a threat to sovereignty in Africa. They are not a threat to our sovereignty at all. But if you're an African country and you feel, and this again is in my book, and if you're an African country and you feel under threat, you may decide you want to employ a South African private security company to help out with the training. Let's see what the US State Department and the Foreign Office does, because it will react against that. You know, it won't want these companies to be involved, and partly because it wants to sell services to these governments. It doesn't want the private sector doing it. Can I just pick up on something that Sorcha mentioned? Sure. You're right. My only criticism at the moment regarding the legal mechanisms, you talked about the Montreux document, which is a very important document and a key document in the development of this industry. But the problem is, it's not legally enforceable. Governments choose to sign that document, full stop. So they don't have to sign it at the end of the day if they don't want to. And the recommendations in that document are not legally binding, if I'm right. You know, and that to me is worrying. And again, I've spoken about the International Code of Conduct. I think it's a wonderful instrument. It's a very important instrument for regulating, self-regulating the industry, for improving standards. And standards have improved massively since I started researching this industry in the 90s. But again, it's self-regulation. you know, and there are a lot of companies out there that don't sign up to this code, you know, and what do we do about them? What I really think we need is a legally binding international convention to sort this industry out once and for all. And I'm hoping that what you mentioned earlier is maybe on the cards at some point. It's going to take probably 2 to 3 decades to get where we need to get. But this is not an industry that's going away. And I do fear that if we move 10, 15 years down the road, we're going to see a lot more of this type of violence. And states need to be prepared for it in this respect, legally, so they can actually do something about it at the end of the day.
Sorka McLeod, you wanted to respond?
Yeah, I'll keep quiet at this point.
Yeah, I mean, just to say, I mean, Chris is right in the sense that the Montreux document itself is not a, it doesn't create any new rules, and it is not binding, and that states, you know, choose to become members of the Montreux document forum. Having said that, the provisions that are within the Montreux document reflect existing international law, which states are bound by. Well, I mean, some states may have a disagreement about that. But from an international legal perspective, that is the position. So it's a little bit more nuanced than saying it's a binding instrument. And again, I would also say there's a little bit more nuance. I don't think Chris and I disagree as far as the International Code of Conduct is concerned, except I would say it's different from pure self-regulation, because the International Code of Conduct Association does have oversight, and there is a, you know, there is a complaints mechanism that exists, and you do have the three pillars of the International Code of Conduct Association. You've got the states, you've got civil society, and you've got the industry. So it's a little bit more nuanced than sort of simple self-regulation. I mean, he's right in the sense that companies choose to become a member of ICOCA or not. And there are some very large private military security companies that have chosen not to become members of ICOCA. And that is a problem. And of course, from the UN Working Group on Mercenaries perspective, an internationally binding instrument that will fill the gap between the international legal framework on mercenaries and the International Code of Conduct is absolutely the way to go.
And Anna Leander, you had some thoughts as well?
Actually, a little bit of a question rather than some thoughts. I have thoughts as well, but I'm curious because from my perspective, and this is really for both Sorcha and Chris and Ori, for everyone, from my perspective, there are a lot of codes. There's a sort of, we also have the PSI, the American ones. We have different state level codes. We have sub-industry codes. We have ISO standards. We have a sort of whole world of competing codes of conduct. And many companies also develop their own. And I think, so the question that I have for you, so now we've talked about the Montreux document, about ICOCA, the Code of Association. We've talked about the open-ended working group. And my question really is, do you think it's possible? So Chris said very starkly, he said, oh, I hope we will have an international instrument to sort this out. And I think the reason we have all these different kinds of regulations going on, Ori early on was talking about the role of contracts as a regulatory instrument at the state level. So the reason is that the sector is so diversified and so complex, and that the boundaries are so unclear, that we actually need all these different regulations going on. So my question really is, like, can we get to where, Chris, do you believe in that? And what about all these other things going on that are around this? We also have I haven't gone into the sort of formal ones, the different regional ones, the African Union, the Latin America. Blah, blah, blah. We have a little plethora of different kinds of regulations. So what does that do to the ones we've been talking about? And what does it do to the possibility to arrive at a sort of overarching general regulation? Can we get there?
And ultimately, Sorka, what I'm thinking of with all this too is that the fragmentation of regulations is a strategy, right? That if you have all these different initiatives, then I know in other industries, so long as there's some form of a labeling initiative or some sort of ways by which the company can say they're bound by at least some principle of regulation or at least standards of practices, you have to be a pretty intense researcher to try to judge which one of these is most restrictive, is most protective, et cetera. I think of when it comes to any sort of industry, so long as you got a label behind you, you can say, I'm corporately responsible. I'm socially responsible.
I mean, I think there's no question that some companies like to you know wear a badge of certification as a you know as a way of indicating that they are ethical or whatever. But I think the answer perhaps lies somewhere in between. So some of the standards that Anna was talking about, so the ISO 18788 standard, PSC1 standard, for example, those were management standards, they're auditing standards, they're management standards that were developed specifically for companies to demonstrate that if they got that certification, that they were complying or at least partially complying with the International Code of Conduct. So those standards work hand in hand with the International Code of Conduct. So a company will say, right, we're members of the International Code of Conduct Association. We want to demonstrate that we're complying with the code. How do we do that? We use third-party auditors and we will get certification to one of the standards that ICOCA recognizes. So, for example, PSC1, which is an American standard, or the international standard ISO 18788. And they will take companies part of the way in demonstrating that they're complying with the International Code of Conduct. And part of that means that they have to put in place human rights policies, corporate governance policies at the corporate level. So there is a bit of consistency there. It's complicated, but there is some you know consistency throughout the different levels. But it, as I've said, it doesn't solve the problem. Now, as far as the international processes are concerned, at the moment there's real polarization. And it comes back, I think, really to the points that Chris and Anna were making right at the beginning of the podcast about political choices in how you label different actors. And so we see some countries saying absolutely it has to be a binding instrument. Other countries are polar opposite, saying, well, we already have the International Code of Conduct, we already have the Montreux document, we don't need anything else. And the reality is that companies are falling through the gap and it's victims and those in vulnerable situations who suffer as a consequence. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see where we are. You know, we're already a decade and a half into the process. And I agree with Chris when he says it's going to be a long way down the line before we get any sort of agreement. The mandate for the open-ended intergovernmental working group is up for renewal at the Human Rights Council of the UN in September, October of this year. And I really hope that it is renewed, because it's really important that the discussion keeps happening. Because if the mandate's not renewed, then the discussion, you know, where will those discussions happen? And that would be hugely problematic. It would be a disaster if states simply are not looking to create some sort of instrument, and ideally a binding instrument. Having said that, you know, we have to be careful that we don't end up with an instrument that lacks credibility or doesn't get a lot of buy-in from states. You know, I mentioned earlier that the UN Convention or the International Convention on Mercenarism only has 37 state parties, and that weakens it, unfortunately. So what's more important is that we get buy-in from all states as to the content of an instrument, and that it should apply to all actors, and focusing on the services that they're offering, private security services, military services, And that it applies globally, that it's not just applying to companies that are offering extraterritorial services. Because as we've been hearing, you know, these companies are moving into all sorts of new spaces, whether it be guarding natural resources like mines and oil installations. They're also operating in migrant detention facilities and at borders. And we saw during COVID that, you know, they were moving into even more new spaces, guarding quarantine hotels and vaccination facilities, for example. So they are, you know, we need to have proper oversight of these actors to protect the most vulnerable.
Ari Swede, you had some thoughts?
So I would like to take a step back to the question you asked Chris, and then return again to that discussion. So you asked Chris if those actors increase the lethality of conflict. So there are some empirical studies that demonstrate that the participation of those actors in conflict increase the lethality, increase the duration of civil war, or I won't say increase, it's associated with, which is the issue of causation here is unproven. But at the same time, those studies define those companies different kind of way than some of us will define them or will understand them. We have serious issues with defining who those actors are, because if Microsoft, as Anna said, start providing cyber tools of surveillance that are military grade, are they private military security company? Or is that service private military security company? And if they stop doing it, then they do it again. I mean, so it's quite fluid and very confusing. And it means that any regulation that will appear will have to account for that fluidity in one way or another, creating clearer boundaries of what essentially we are talking about, which would be a massive challenge. Now, beyond that, if we talk about lethality and oversight, if we have actors like Wagner that are supported by a very powerful state, it doesn't really matter what we will regulate. They won't call it private military security company. They will call it militia. They will call it something else. And they will break the law, that they will act in a way that will increase lethality, that will increase instability. They will use that entity as a tool to promote their policy in one way or another. And this is, again, something we need to take into consideration, understand the limitations of those tools. Those tools are not a panacea. It's not a silver bullet. They can help us improve things. But if someone, especially if it's a powerful state, decide to break the rules, it would be really, really hard for us as international community to address that.
Anna Leander, I'm going to give you the last word. It seems to me whether or not these corporations are regulated, still, I mean, there's technical issues, there's legal questions, but really at the end of the day, it's the willingness of the states to regulate them. Do you think with more news coming out about some of the excesses of some of these corporations, that there is the political will on states and perhaps democratic states, undemocratic states to actually regulate, or is it going to remain a bit of a wild west?
Oh gosh, I have at least 5 hours worth of comments. So just super briefly. So I think we have, Chris is right to point out the reluctance of states to publicize these things. And Sorce is right to insist that actually we do have legal binding instruments. And one of the things that strikes me is that on average, it's very difficult to actually use these instruments because there's a lot of resistance, and it's by states, but it's also by other users of these companies. So I think it's very important to improve these instruments. I really believe that we need, like, no law isn't obeyed in any field always. So, you know, the fact that it doesn't always work isn't a good reason to not work with it. And the fact that it's complex, however, I think also should tell us that we need to work on multiple forms of regulation, as in other areas. There's a, anyway, long story, so I'm not going to go there. our main problem really is the attachment. We don't want to limit this too much. And when I say we, I mean everyone using them, and that's by now literally everyone. And as I said, that includes academics like me, obviously. So we should really ask ourselves questions about how we see this and get away from the willingness basically to sanction a constant expansion of this market that's rather unreflective and get a hold of that. That I think, and that's not a regulatory issue, that's an issue of how we think about the status of commercial security. Sorry, I'm sure that was more than 2 minutes, but thanks a lot. I hope it made sense. I tried to compress too much into that answer. Thank you, Doug.
Yeah, no, it does indeed. And I think at the end of the day, political will and the desire of the actors who are actually contracting with the private military corporations really seem, in my mind, to hold the key to the effective regulation and control of their activities. Our guests today have been Christopher Kinsey, lecturer in the Defense Studies Department at King's College London and the author of Corporate Soldiers and International Security, The Rise of Private Military Companies. Anna Leander is the chair and professor of the International Relations and Political Science Department at Geneva Graduate Institute. She's the author of The Power to Construct International Security on the Significance of Private Military Companies. Ori Swed is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work at Texas Tech University. He's the author of No Accounting for Bad Contracting, Private Military and Security Contracts and Ineffective Regulation in Conflict Areas. And Sorka McLeod, associate professor at the University of Copenhagen and a member of the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries. She's the author of Certifying Private Security Companies, Effectively Ensuring the Corporate Responsibility to Respect Human Rights. Thank you all very much for your insights and for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.